You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Celia Belin, and I am a visiting fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. It is a pleasure to welcome you today to the 16th Raymond Aron Lecture. This lecture series was launched in 2004 and is named in honor of a great Frenchman, Raymond Aron, who was a renowned political scientist, philosopher, journalist, and a great friend of the United States. Before we dive into this year's lecture, I'd like to first take a moment to thank our partner. We are very grateful to the Embassy of France for their collaboration and support over the years. I want to particularly recognize Ambassador Philippe Etienne and the team at the French policy planning led by Manuel Lafont-Rapnouille at the Quai d'Orsay. Thank you for your support. Today, it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Pap Ndiaye, who, like Raymond Aron, is a great friend of the United States. Pap Ndiaye will give this year's Raymond Aron lecture on a topic of great importance on both sides of the Atlantic, the question of anti-racist movements both in France and in the United States. A little bit more than a year ago, George Floyd was murdered, and his televised death compelled millions of Americans across the country to protest racism and police brutality. Throughout 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic raged in the US and across the world, the Black Lives Matter movement inspired a global discourse on race and racism. The movement found an echo in France, which has also been experiencing its own anti-racist reckoning. No one is better placed to provide a comparative reading of anti-racist movements in France and in the US as Dr. Pap Ndiaye. Dr. Pap Ndiaye is professor of history at Sciences Po in Paris and is the director of the Palais de la Porte Dorée, home to the French National Museum of the History of Immigration. As a historian, Dr. Ndiaye focuses on African American history and on the transnational philosophies of race, drawing from both American and French thought. He notably authored an essay in 2008, entitled La Condition Noire, The Black Condition, which pioneered the field of French Black Studies, which is why it is our distinct privilege that he accepted our offer to give his perspective on movements for racial justice on both sides of the Atlantic. We are also honored to be joined this morning by Dr. Rashawn Ray, a David Rubenstein Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at Brookings, who will offer a response to Dr. Ndiaye's remark. Dr. Ray is also a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. His research focuses on the mechanism that manufacture and maintain racial and social inequality, with a particular focus on police-civilian relations. And last but not least, our very own Dr. Camille Bussette will moderate a conversation between Dr. Ndiaye and Ray. Dr. Camille Bussette is the director of the Race, Prosperity and Inclusion Initiative at Brookings and a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program. Dr. Bussette's work focuses on systemic racism and the question of economic advancement. I expect this to be a fascinating conversation. Finally, we are on the record today and streaming live. So please send your questions via email to events@brookings.edu or on Twitter using the hashtag AronLecture. Once again, thank you all for joining us this morning for this important conversation. Dr. Pap Ndiaye, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Celia. Thank you so much for this great and wonderful invitation by the Brookings. Thank you also to the French Embassy in Washington, D.C. It's a great pleasure and a great honor for me to speak this morning or this afternoon, Paris time, on indeed a very important topic, that of the anti-racist movement in France, in light of the recent events a year ago that took place in the United States and that had such a strong echo throughout the world, including in France, of course. In my short presentation, I want to discuss and highlight a few points that may be of interest to all of you. I want first, obviously to insist on the international dimension of the anti-racist movement, including in countries in Europe which didn't have previously so much of a strong history of organized anti-racist organization. Think of Switzerland, for example, which had such large demonstrations a year ago in Geneva or Zurich. In France, tens of demonstrations took place last June and early July, including large demonstrations in Paris by early June, gathering tens of thousands of people, which I will discuss briefly later. My main point here is that it is important to look at the movement not as a spin-off of the US movement, the French movement, not being a byproduct of the US mobilization that took place a year ago. Journalists and commentators mostly insist on the US origin, on George Floyd's murder and the echoes which this murder had throughout the world, which is true, obviously. But what I insist on too is that it is important to focus on the local dynamics, on the national dynamics, which is not to say that the murder of George Floyd had no importance, obviously. So what I want to resist here is the idea that anti-racism is an American import, which is something that may be quite commonly heard in France, or some people would speak of the Americanization of anti-racism in France. So I want to discuss this, and I will also focus on another important issue, which is that of the originality of the movement, of the anti-racist movement in 2020 as compared to earlier anti-racist movements, and end with a question about the main differences between the French mobilization and what took place, the American mobilization, at the same time. I think it's nice to have some kind of comparative perspective. So let me get back to my first question, which is that of the long history of anti-racist organizations in France, which can be traced back to the 1920s following the First World War. So we're talking about a century of anti-racist organizations. Well, we could think of the League of Human Rights that was created in the very late 19th century. But the 1920s are quite original in the sense that a number of organizations, race-based organizations, were created. In my work, I mostly focused on leagues created by Black activists and intellectuals in the 1920s, the League to Defense of Black People, for example. A number of them were created at that time with connections with the United States. Du Bois was red. Du Bois traveled and stayed in Paris in the first months, few months of 1919. Marcus Garvey also traveled to Paris and was well known and translated in Paris at that time, Kojo Tuvalu, one of these French African activists, traveled to attend to New York to attend the annual meeting of the United Negro Improvement Association, the association by Marcus Garvey at that time. So we are talking about this long history of anti-racist organizations, which parallels that of the United States that had its ups and downs. There is no central organization such as the NAACP in France, for sure, but a number of organizations have survived, sometimes for a few years, sometimes a little longer, throughout the 20th century, up until a recent revival in the years 2000, with creations of Le Cran, for example, in 2005, and more recently, a number of Black Lives Matter groups that mushroomed in the around 2013, 2014. So when we speak of Black Lives Matter in France, we're not talking about something that was created a year ago. We're talking about something that has been around for a while. When I taught at Sciences Po up until recently, every year I participated in a meeting organized by the Sciences Po Black Lives Matter France group. Each time there were about anywhere between 50 and 80 people attending those meetings. And this was before the murder of George Floyd. So this long history needs to be taught, needs to be told, needs to be remembered for sure. In parallel to this history, there is also a long history of intellectuals reflecting on racial issues in France. Think of the Negritude movement, of course, as it appeared around 1935 with Senghor, Césaire, and Damas, of course, all connected actually to U.S. intellectuals through the Nardal sisters, who are more and more well-known now as they were a little bit swept on the side by the male founders of the Negritude. Think of the Présence Africaine journal and publisher that was created in 1947 in Paris. And if you get through the Présence Africaine journal, you will read and you will realize how broad the scope was and the number of prominent intellectuals published in Présence Africaine, including Frantz Fanon, actually. Before publishing Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, Fanon published a paper in Présence Africaine as well as in another intellectual journal in the early 1950s. Think also, of course, of the famous 1956 Congress at the Sorbonne University of Black creators and intellectuals that had such a deep echo and impact in France, with also U.S. Intellectuals and novelists coming from the U.S. or who lived in France at that time. See Richard Wright, for example, Du Bois couldn't come. Others coming from West Africa, from Haiti, from the Caribbean in general. All this was made, this long intellectual history is very precious, because when looking at the relationship with the U.S., with African-American thinkers and intellectuals, first of all, W.E.B. Du Bois, it is important to look at that in both directions. Historians of the Harlem Renaissance, for example, know that it is almost impossible to study the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s without making the international connections with Paris, with London, also with the Caribbean, that help understand what the Harlem Renaissance was all about in the at that time in the 1920s. But think also of the dialogue, this long conversation on race that has existed for a century between U.S. and French intellectuals. And when we speak of that, it's not only about the U.S. influence over French intellectuals, it is also about the French influence over these African-American writers and intellectuals, the best example being that of Frantz Fanon. Frantz Fanon had a deep influence over the Black Power movement in the 1960s and a deep intellectual influence throughout the end of the 20th century, to such a point that as a grad student, I discovered Frantz Fanon in the United States, not in France. In France, I had never heard of Fanon. I came to realize how important Fanon's writing was when in the United States. And I first read Fanon in English, not in French, because it was not easy to read and to hear about Fanon in France a few decades ago. When mentioning Fanon, people would laugh. People would say, oh, he's a kind of, you know, marginal writer. So he was definitely swept under the rug. So it is absolutely crucial to look at this long conversation as a way to criticize, of course, those who would argue and would speak of the recent Americanization of the anti-racist movement. Now, it is also true that we have witnessed a revival and changes in French anti-racism since since 2005 or the late 2000s, with US influence, it is true that a number of people who have contributed to think about or to rethink about these issues have spent time in the United States, including myself. But again, this is not about Americanizing the French situation. It is about reading, it is about reinterpreting. It is about also engaging into a fruitful conversation with our American colleagues and friends. So again, this long history needs to be taught, because the classic cultural and intellectual history of France tends to neglect, at best, issues of race that are seen as foreign to our own society, that are seen as an American import once again, when we need to realize that these issues have been discussed, have been taught in deep and interesting ways, most often uphill, most often in marginal ways, as opposed to the centrality of issues such as a class in a Marxist sense, that has very much organized the way the social sciences have looked at inequalities in French society. Women and have also had to face similar issues when women's studies, the history of women and gender studies were on the rise in the 1970s and 80s. Women, female scholars had also to face a number of criticism, saying, oh, these are in parts, this is not the reality of French society. We have a history of gallantry in France that protects us against what could exist in the United States, and so on and so forth. So it is always a tendency in France and possibly elsewhere to explain the rise of new intellectual or not so new intellectual thinking as coming from abroad, as not being local, when in reality, we are talking about local realities, the reality of racial inequalities in France and the reality of those who studied these inequalities in France as well, in conversation with activists and intellectuals abroad. The point I want to follow up on too is precisely what happened a year ago with the murder of George Floyd, as the demonstrators were protesting, of course, what happened in Minneapolis, but also what happened in France, and issues of race profiling by the police, as well as police brutalities, sometimes in a very racist way. And the demonstrators most often associated George Floyd with Adama Traoré, this young man who died in police custody in July of 2016. So the demonstrations were very much with George Floyd and Adama Traoré, the US reference, as well as a local situation which was similar, although not the same as what happened in the United States. So each time, and this would be true actually in other countries in Europe, in the UK, in Germany, in Switzerland, people would protest what happened in the US while also talking about events, while also talking about forms of violence and structural racism that do exist in their respective countries, sometimes not with Black people being race profiled, but sometimes with local situations, minorities, one way or another. The second point is the originality of the 2020 events and how original are those events, the demonstrations and the talks and the writings as compared to the previous time. The first point I would highlight is that the demonstrations were definitely more diverse than the previous anti-racist demonstrations. If you compare the demonstrations taking place in 2016 following the death of Adama Traoré, as you will see on a few photos, people were mostly Black people, Afro-European people, Africans and of African and Caribbean descent, as opposed to the demonstrations that took place a year ago, where a large share of the demonstrators were white people. So that's something quite interesting to witness, and I had never witnessed that for a very long time, this broadening of the a more diverse group of people demonstrating. And these are things quite similar, I understand, that took place in the United States a year ago as well. The second point I would highlight is that the demonstrations took place in highly central neighborhoods in Paris, for example, or in Marseille, in Lyon, in Rouen, in Strasbourg, not in the suburbs, unlike the demonstrations that took place the previous years, but in highly central neighborhoods in the urban space, people being in very central ways, which was smart as a way to attract more people through local transportation, of course, but also as a way to be more visible. And this is something that might echo demonstrations that took place also in the United States at the same time. The third originality I would highlight is that women were at the forefront. This is not to say that women were not in the anti-racist movement throughout the 20th century. On the contrary, women have always been highly central, but women were not at the forefront as a spokesperson, as leading the movement. When in France, we have witnessed this shift from men to women when it comes to anti-racist movement, the Black Lives Matter France organizers are mostly young women. So this is something which I'm very happy about for sure, which is quite original and quite interesting. And again, we might compare this French situation to the US or possibly to the UK, where a new generation of young women, young activists, have taken the lead and also, of course, built and thought about the connections between various forms of racial inequality, but also gender inequality, much to the despair of conservative thinkers who regret what they see again as an American import, which, of course, is not correct. The last point I want to, I'm not sure about the time, but I believe that my time is close to the end, right? The last point I want to highlight are the differences between France and the US. How different are the the anti-racist movement in the US from that of France? I could first mention, of course, the scale. The scale is different. Of course, France is a smaller country for sure. The anti-racist movement on the European scale doesn't have the same homogeneity and the same lines as the US anti-racist movement. So it's more diverse. It's not as united. If I don't want to exaggerate the homogeneity of the anti-racist movement in the US, of course, but the European situation is a little different. So it's a difference of scale that could be seen as quite obvious. But what I would like to insist a little more is the history of anti-racism in France, which is often seen as a history of defeats. It's a history of recent defeats with the rise of extreme right movements since the mid-1980s, of course. And when looking at the past, it is often seen as something a little, you know, a little that doesn't give much hope. It's sometimes seen with a little despair, with also the decolonization processes that was not smooth, to say the least, in France, with two wars, including two major wars, let's put it that way, in Indochina and Algeria, with deep scars that the war in Algeria has left on French society. But in contrast to the United States, I would say that we never had the equivalent of the civil rights movement. So there is no history from the French standpoint. There is no history. There are no heroes. There are no heroes of anti-racism, larger than life figures to which people could refer. We don't have a Dr. King. We don't have a Malcolm X. We don't have these giants, which is not to say that there are no people in France, no heroes of anti-racism. But those heroes or those people have often been marginalized or are celebrated in decolonized countries as people who fought against French colonialism. So the narrative of anti-racism in France doesn't have the great moments, so to speak, which it has in the United States. So it is not easy for young activists in France or for those who want to get into the anti-racist movement to think about this history. They don't have much to say about this history in contrast, again, with the United States. So one important thing, I think, when looking at this long history of anti-racism in France would be to reflect on this history and to build a narrative that would unite this history, that would unite also people who may be celebrated in their newly independent countries but are not seen as French or are not seen as part of French history. This includes also issues related to slavery, as slavery is quite often seen in France as foreign, but the French, of course, slavery is part of French history, and we need also to tell about the resistance to French slavery, the heroes that fought and sometimes and often died, of course, fighting slavery. So all this, I think, is a significant difference when comparing the French and US situation. I just want to end with a few photos of the movement last year, just for you to have a sense of how it looked like. I hope you see the photos. So this is a photo of 2005 following the death of two young teenagers that prompted an uprising, a major uprising in the suburbs of Paris and elsewhere in France. So these are the people, mostly young people protesting in France and engaging into a revival of this anti-racist movement, which I told you about earlier. This is a photo now of following the death of Adama Traoré, just to as a way for you to illustrate the fact that few white persons participated in these demonstrations, as you can guess on this photo. And these demonstrations were, in fact, much, much smaller than the demonstrations that took place in Paris last year. This is a Paris mural by a very famous artist named J.R. And this is this. You had the eye of George Floyd on one side and the eye of Adama Traoré. So they're all united, you see, on the same wall on a building in the 10th arrondissement in Paris. These are demonstrators. What is an originality also the demonstrators was that English was used, and it was quite new to me to see English language being used in those demonstrations. You see, we can breath. I'm of the color of those who are being persecuted, as it says on the left in French. These are also photographs of people, demonstrators. Of course, George Floyd was very much there. Black Lives Matter in the background. You can see here people demonstrating using English. Again, sometimes the I can breath being translated. You see here, I want, je veux respirer. It means I want to breath in French. You can see also there's demonstrators in Paris. There were several demonstrations, largest, bringing together tens of thousands of people in spite of being said illegal by the police for sanitary reason, COVID reason. Again, photos, young people, but you see how diverse it is. Just to give you a sense of what I'm talking about with this idea of there's large crowds and this diversity. Okay, I have already spoken too much, so I'm going to end here. Thank you.
Dr. Njai, thank you so much for a superb and very thoughtful consideration of the dynamic and longstanding anti-racist movement in France. You have brought up so many interesting themes that I know we will probably end up running out of time to discuss everything, particularly with our audience. For everybody who has joined us, I really want to welcome you. Thank you for joining us on this very interesting topic. And it's been an absolute pleasure to hear Dr. Ndai give his perspective. We are now going to move to Dr. Ray, who is going to give us a bit of a response to Dr. Ndai's perspective. And then from there on, we will have a very fast conversation between the three of us, and then we will move to audience question and answer. So with that, Dr. Ray.
Thank you, Dr. Bousset. I really enjoy the comments, the presentation that was made. There are many parallels between the United States and France. I'll aim to highlight a few of them. I mean, first, when we talk about protest mobilization and we look at what's been happening around the world, not just in the Americas, not just in Europe, but literally around the world. I mean, of course, there's this centering around George Floyd's murder. I think a lot of that is situated in the fact that we have video evidence. But of course, as many people that came out in summer 2021, we know that this has been a buildup over a number of years that has really led to this spillover point. We know before summer 2021, some of the largest protests we had seen was the Women's March in the United States in January 2017, which also spread around the world as well, and also had a social media component, which is a theme that I'm going to highlight as we go along. We know before that, Michael Brown's killing in Ferguson, Missouri, and the non-indictment of former officer Darren Wilson for his killing in November 2014 really helped spark the Black Lives Matter movement. But of course, BLM has origins in the killing of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman, who of course was acquitted for killing a 17-year-old who was going to the store and had purchased iced tea, and some Skittles. And as we think about this moment, and we think about the connection between protest and pandemics, this is nothing new, not only to the United States, but to other parts of the world, as Jennifer Roberts recently wrote for Brookings, How We Rise. And it speaks to a racial awakening that we're in right now that we haven't seen for a half a century or more. And it's shifting attitudes. I think the key question people are now starting to figure out is what else is it going to shift? I mean, it's teetering when it comes to policy. But we also know that there's a backlash to some of that that I think we'll get to, that we heard from Dr. Ndiaye about right-wing extremists and white nationalists that have been popping up not only in the U.S., but also in Europe, and oftentimes has some stronger historical connections in parts of Europe like France and Germany and Great Britain that obviously has links to what happens in the United States. And accordingly, people are starting to recognize that slavery in the U.S. is linked to European colonialism in Africa. And of course, when we think about that, it collectively has roots in how we think about anti-Blackness around the world. And I think that is a key point, particularly when we think about the academic writings of people that we heard mentioned, from Frantz Fanon to W.E.B. Du Bois to even others we can include like James Baldwin and many more who we could also mention. But I think in terms of talking about academics, oftentimes they are the way that we can make these connections theoretically, substantively, and empirically. When I think about Du Bois, I also think about people like Carol Anderson, who I think is one of the best minds and writers of our time, who is a professor at Emory University in Atlanta. One of her recent books is not only called The Second and About the Second Amendment, but the book before that was called White Rage, which actually popped up yesterday during the congressional hearing with General Milley. And he talked about how we need to link white rage to the January 6th insurgency. And I think that is important to make that note, that this is coming from the highest echelons of the military. And well, of course, when we talk about the U.S. military and we think about the way that the United States has infiltrated various areas around the world, we can make those important connections from the academic to the policy space and to obviously what's happening in the streets. But of course, in the U.S. context, one of the things that the U.S. does that is different in some ways to what happens in France and in other parts of Europe, as we think about kind of group identity and collectivism versus individualism, is that in the U.S., we over-individualize things. So as we heard mentioned about Dr. King or Malcolm X, I mean, these are, of course, people that we should hold up, but there are many others that we don't have a good history about because of the ways in which the United States actually frames history and the way that ethnocentrism operates in the U.S. And accordingly, when we talk about police, which is one of the big elephants in the room and the reason why this mobilization is happening, is if we, as bad as police killings are right now in the U.S., and I'll get to that in a second, there were more people killed by police in the 1960s. And importantly, Black civil rights leaders were being killed off. There are many that we can mention that had that particular pattern. And I think when we collectively think about this, it speaks to what happens in schools and the current debate that is going on around critical race theory and what students learn in school, which I think is important. You know, there's a quote that I heard recently that I think is pretty profound, which is that if Black kids are old enough to experience racism, white kids in America are old enough to learn about it. And I think that is the ways that we move on, whether we're talking about in the U.S. context, whether we're talking about in France or other parts around the world. Now, of course, one of the differences that people always try to note between the United States and France and other parts of Europe, and it's notable, but not in the way that people think about it. And Dr. Ndiaye really highlighted this. So we know that over 1,000 people are killed by police in the U.S. every year. That's about a person every 8 hours. But this doesn't mean that racial profiling and brutalization does not occur in places like France. It definitely does. One of the key differences is the way that guns operate in the U.S. compared to France. But that doesn't mean that we still don't see racial profiling of Black people in France, even when there's a citizenship component to it, which is also another important difference to note, that citizenship matters in certain ways in France in ways that in the US context, we see it not mattering as much when we look at the rollback of voting rights, when we look at some of the restrictions of people's ability to navigate public space. So we can think through that. The final point I'll make is about the power of social media to circumvent traditional modes of communication and education, like in schools. We also know that social media has helped to highlight the relegation of women's voices and perspectives. This is why parallel hashtags or movements, if you will, like Say Her Name, is so important. Some of the research I've done with some of my colleagues, Melissa Brown, who's at Stanford in particular, is we did an analysis of Twitter during the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. And we found that women who were leaders of the movement were less likely to be highlighted in the media. They were less likely to be retweeted. They was less likely to be followed on social media. And this is part of the reason why Say Her Name has popped up. So in addition to thinking about people like who lost their lives, like Breonna Taylor and Sandra Bland, it's also all the ones we don't know. Like one of the ones I always hold up is Corinne Gaines. Corinne Gaines was killed by police in Baltimore County, Maryland, and the settlement for her killing is $38 million. We put that in perspective to the $27 million that George Floyd's family is receiving, or the settlement, not necessarily all the money they're receiving after lawyer fees and all the stuff and the complications of the way the U.S. Criminal justice system operates. But just think about it, that is a settlement in a case that most people don't know. And I think it speaks collectively to the ways that we receive information and the way that social media can be used to circumvent traditional modes of communication. So I'll stop there and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. This has been an excellent set of perspectives and lots of interesting topics that I think we'll have a chance to cover in some depth. I wanted to start, Dr. Ndiaye, with a question for you. Given the long history of anti-racism movements in France, I think it would be helpful to our audience to understand what has been the official response to the demands that have been made, over that long history. What has there been progress? If so, what is it? If not, why is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an important question. There's a Indeed, there are official answers, of course, which basically revolve around the longstanding French, let's say, political tradition to be officially colorblind. France is colorblind, so as a colorblind country, we don't have any problems of racism, right? Because we don't care about skin color. Skin color doesn't matter more than eye color or hair color in France. That, you know, that could be the official answer. And the French pride themselves of having had no, segregation laws, no Jim Crow laws. There is a long tradition of African-American intellectuals and writers coming to France as a way to escape racial violence in the United States, all starting in the 1920s. So France has also this image of being a country where the most brutal forms of racism do not exist the way they existed in the United States. And yet, when looking a little closer, clearly things are not so obvious, and I like often to remind my students that in the early 1960s, we're close to the 60th anniversary of what happened on October 17th, 1961, when the police in Paris killed hundreds of people. Hundreds of Algerians were thrown into the Seine River in the most brutal and lethal ways. So when talking about these forms of violence, we also have a long history of it. But officially speaking, colorblindness, French universalism is supposed to protect us against the most brutal forms of racism. And so it's often a form of denial, which is a little less true these days, as the French government has created official agencies to fight racial discrimination in France. But this official agency is often seen as a problem by the French government, which does not often listen closely to what people specialized in racial discrimination have to say. So I think, to sum it up, I think the French have moved to a light form of denial. You know, it's not perfect in France, but it's worse elsewhere, especially in the United States. That could be something like the official discourse that can be found in France.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Ray, in contrast, would you say that we've had a different policymaker response, particularly to the Black Lives Matter demands, but in general, how would you contrast official responses with what Dr. Njai has just mentioned?
Yeah, I think it depends on who you ask. I think that the big point that we just heard is from the top down, it is a very colorblind approach in France, which we can even juxtapose not only to the US, but also to Great Britain and Germany, and the different ways in which they even classify people. And I think that is an important point. I mean, whether or not we talk about information that's collected during a pandemic like COVID, for example, racial data and otherwise. So in the US is, people would say, is quite racially conscious. But when we look at the response really depends on who we ask when it comes down to policy. There are some people, particularly on the right, Mitch McConnell has said this a lot, that he thinks that having a Black president and ending slavery 156 years ago is enough for us to get past racism. But instead, there are tons of outcomes that we could highlight why that actually falls short of reaching a true equitable democracy in the United States. And that's fundamentally because the U.S. has never truly dealt with slavery or anti-Blackness. And I think it's important for people to recognize that Reconstruction in the United States failed. And we don't have time for me to go into a soliloquy and a history lesson on that, but that is important to note. I think the other thing is how we think about voter turnout. We know that in the 2020 U.S. election, more people came out to vote than ever before, had percentage-wise one of the highest voter turnouts ever. And in response to that, there are some state legislatures and even some in Congress who have made it more difficult to vote for certain people in states. Like in my great state of Tennessee, where I was born in Murfreesboro, it's easier to buy a gun than vote. And I think that speaks to one of the key differences between the US and France in terms of access to certain types of weapons, which I think when it comes to policing, then fuels a level of threat that doesn't exist in the same way in France as it does in the United States. It leads to a justification of a use of force in the US context. We also know that, look, there's a lot of symbolism in the US. I mean, look, Juneteenth was just passed as the 11th federal holiday. And while it's important, as I wrote for How We Rise and with Andre Perry, that we need to celebrate this, that we need to embrace it, I want people to think about this. And since France neighbors Germany, and I don't think I've said this here, but I spent some time teaching at the University of Mannheim in Germany and spent quite a bit of time in Europe, obviously, including in France. And think about it like this. Imagine if the only thing that Germany had done to this point is to give a federal holiday 156 years after the Holocaust. Of course, this is even fast forwarding more. That is the current state as it relates to the relationship between the United States engaging in a restorative process. The other thing is the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act has not passed Congress yet. It passed the House of Representatives. I was with Congresswoman Karen Bass, who helped to draft that legislation earlier this week, and supposedly something is coming because we know that Derek Chauvin is going to be sentenced tomorrow unless they end up moving that back. So we can think about these connections that, yes, it's a lot of attitudinal shift. Yes, it's a lot of cultural shifting. Yes, it's symbolism. But that does not always come along with transformative and reparative policy.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Ray. Dr. Njai, did you want to respond to that? I have another question, of course, but if you looked as you looked very engaged, I wanted to make sure that we were able to accommodate you if you wanted to.
I wholeheartedly agree with what Roshan just said. I just want to mention as a way to be in line with his comments is the fact that in France we do not have racial statistics that could properly highlight the forms of inequalities I'm talking about. And when it comes to the COVID crisis, we suspect, of course, and we have many testimonies that non-whites have paid a higher price to the crisis than white people. But officially speaking, we don't know. We have no idea about that, no clear idea. Unlike the United States, we know that African Americans had twice as many dead people than white people. And this is all lacking. So we have a deficit of knowledge when it comes to addressing these issues, which is, of course, also a testimony of this colorblind policy I'm talking about. Although it is possible to have the statistics, I mean, but in a kind of unofficial way on the side. And when it comes to the health crisis, it is quite clear that we don't have and we won't have any statistics beyond statistics related to geography and class, what the French usually do.
Thank you, Dr. Njie. I want to stay with you and ask you a little bit about racism and that term and how it is understood and maybe how those meanings have shifted and evolved over time with the anti-racist movement in France. When you think about racism and that term, how are you thinking about it? How are folks in the anti-racist movement in France thinking about that? And how do you think that might contrast with the U.S. Kind of definition and narrative around racism? And then, Roshan, I'm going to ask you the same thing.
Yeah, it's an important question because for the longest time, racism in France was felt in terms that were deeply influenced by the Second World War and the decolonization movement of the 1950s. So racism was about fighting evil, was about fighting the deep forces of evil and uprooting. Anti-racism was about uprooting the bad representation and stereotypes and prejudice that people may have. So education was seen as highly central as a way to fight racism in the official policies. When in the same time, a major issue was swept on the side, which was the issue of discriminations. Racism was seen as, you know, the most brutal, obvious ideological forms of racism coming from the long French history of official racism in the social sciences, for example, in official discourses before the Second World War. But in the other hand, racial discrimination, the fact that people cannot get a job or cannot rent an apartment or can be harassed by the police, was something that the French never addressed up until recently when this agency was created in the years 2000. So we've seen this interesting shift from fighting racism as an ideology, as it was the case for decades, to fighting in more pragmatic ways the effects of racism and the issue of racial discrimination, which have come to the forefront as people realize that not finding a job because you're Black is a central issue that has deep consequence on life. And this issue is possibly as important, if not more important, for those involved, directly concerned people, than the issue of fighting racism as an ideology in the traditional sense of the word.
Thank you. Dr. Ray?
Yes, I mean, most definitely. I mean, look, when we talk about racism, and defining it, racism operates on multiple levels. We oftentimes overly simplify it as being interpersonal, as something that happens in a social interaction between two people or groups of people. But instead, it's part of this racial awakening is doing for not just people in the United States, but people in Europe and around the world, is leveling up this knowledge to understand that racism operates also on a systemic level to influence our social institutions. Historically, as we just heard, there's been a reliance when we talk about race to situate racial differences to be about biology and genetics, because we're still limited on the variables that we use to capture racism. It's been difficult to capture systemic racism in statistical models because we overly rely on attitudinal variables. And even as you all know, as social scientists, we overwhelmingly do that. We take an attitudinal variable and then we make interpretive leaps that we get, but it's difficult for people to know. And so systemically in the United States, we know that racism exists in the housing market, whether that be with appraisals, whether that be with the type of loan that people receive for their home, or whether or not people even receive it. Job seekers who are seeking a job, there's evidence documenting that if a Black person attended an Ivy League school, that does little to actually give them a boost, even over people who attended a state school. And of course, we could get into the details on whether or not that should even be the case or not. But nonetheless, we see a racial gap there. We also know that Black people who don't have a criminal record, research is documented, are actually less likely to be hired or called back for a job than white people who do have a criminal record. In policing, obviously, we know that Black people are actually more likely to be killed by police when they're not attacking and do not have a weapon, not just to whites, but even to the baseline of the number of Black people that are killed. And then in health, I think it's important to note that there's a lack of empathy. Not only do I think the maternal and infant mortality gap between Blacks and whites is one of the most horrendous things that we could point to. And of course, there is an over-reliance on biology and genetics until people like Beyonce or Serena Williams come out, who are two of the fittest people on the planet, come out and talk about their own birthing experience. We also know that Black people oftentimes get lower quality organs for transplants like kidneys. And then in the NFL, where they just had a multi-billion dollar lawsuit, even at baseline for what they considered intelligence, and I don't even have time to get into the details here, but at baseline, Black players were viewed as having a lower intelligence level. So that means in order to show that you have a deterioration from playing football, you actually have to score even lower on the test. In France, as we heard, the making of migrants and the importance of citizenship is really played up because the data for highlighting racial differences doesn't always exist in France as it does in the United States. And I think the bottom line is that data is really important to be able to firmly get at people's everyday experiences.
Thank you. I want to press a little bit more and talk a little about anti-Black racism in particular and how that manifests itself and how that is actually how that is countered by the anti-racist movements, both in the U.S. and in France. So Dr. Ndiaye, I'm going to have you speak to that first.
Yeah, I think that these are similarities between France and the U.S. when looking at the specificities of anti-Black racism as opposed to anti-Arab racism, which is also very strong in France. Anti-Black racism, it seems to me, from an anthropological standpoint, has this uniqueness of being obsessed with Black bodies, this obsession and this centrality over Black bodies, over the threat by Black bodies, or what Black bodies mean, is quite unique, I would argue, to the various forms of racism that have existed for centuries. Of course, it is linked to slavery and to the numerous discourses that have been developed since the 16th century to connect slavery, modern slavery, to the enslavement of Africans as opposed to earlier forms of slavery. So I think that this focus, this obsession with Black bodies and how to make Black bodies work and make profit, and in the same time controlling Black bodies because they represent a threat by all means, from a medical standpoint, but also as a physical presence, is really central. And when thinking of the murder of George Floyd, for example, or the murder of so many young Black men in the past, it is often quite striking to see that the use of violence by the police, see how George Floyd was killed by this knee over his neck for 8 or 9 minutes, it represents this idea of controlling the body, of making sure that the body doesn't move, that this George Floyd, this muscular man, was being properly controlled. So this is really, really, to me, very central, as opposed to anti-Arab racism that exists, that is very strong in France, which has an obsession, which is more toward religion, you know, the beliefs, or anti-Asian racism, which has also different forms. So I would highlight the centrality of the anthropological centrality of Black bodies.
Great, thank you. Dr. Ray.
Yes, I mean, I'm over here taking notes because, I mean, that really captured. I mean, look, in the U.S. context, everything is situated in comparison to Blackness. The one drop rule, which originates back to slavery, meaning if you had one drop of Black blood, you were considered Black. Of course, this was one of the ways that slave owners were able to continue to relegate Black people, even children that they actually birthed. And of course, led to a host of things, whether that be about the brown paper bag test and the role of skin tone in the U.S. context, which operates in France and in Europe in similar ways, but oftentimes in a very stronger component in the way we just heard, not just about Blackness and whiteness, but also whether what part of Northern Africa you're from, or what part of supposedly the Middle East you're from, and what your skin tone is. And even within the same race, we see the juxtaposition of the way that people are treated, which really in the U.S. context speaks to people's ability to supposedly pass. But what I always find interesting about this is interesting how we never prime whiteness as a race. And when we do, like the current discourse in America, the backlash is sharp and fierce. America overwhelmingly emphasizes whiteness in economic terms. And by doing that, we miss some very important components of what happens in people's everyday lives that social scientists have pulled out theoretically, that historians have pulled out theoretically, and even humanists, to highlight that whiteness is much deeper and goes beyond economics. We can't simply think about it like that, because, of course, there are tons of poor white people in the United States. And they say, oh, you want to talk to me about racism? Look at my everyday life. And part of what people are trying to say is, look, yes, there's a huge economic component, but whiteness also brings along with its social and cultural benefits that are not discussed enough. And so by focusing on Blackness alone, we miss this. It is only then when we center what Du Bois calls the wages of whiteness, do we get Carol Anderson's highlight of white rage and what happened on January 6th.
Well, excellent. And of course, very provocative, which is fantastic for our audience. I'm going to go to one more question for the two of you, and then we're going to move on to audience question and answer. So this question is really about public spaces and what happens when Blacks or others who are targeted by racism and discrimination occupy those public spaces, and how and if those public spaces are regulated and how that kind of regulation of public space may or may not differ in the US and France. And so I'm gonna actually start with Dr. Ray, and then Dr. Ndai, you will have the last word of this section.
So I've done a lot of research on what happens in public spaces, particularly around physical activity. I want to juxtapose the experience of Ahmaud Arbery, who was a 20-something-year-old Black man who was killed in Southern Georgia for running in a predominantly white neighborhood. We can also think about a student at Yale University who was sleeping in the common area. Students do that all the time. And she had the police called on her. And of course, she was a Black student. And collectively, what this speaks to is the protection of white spaces. That when we talk about policing, oftentimes policing oftentimes has the liberty to engage in state sanctioned violence to protect property over people. If we think about the protests last year and some of the narratives that were coming out of law enforcement, some of the narratives that were coming out of the media, it was about protecting property over people. And part of what the protesters were trying to say is that, look, we don't want to see buildings burned down either, but buildings can be replaced. People's physical bodies cannot. And I think that is something to highlight when we talk about a reliance on public spaces that oftentimes is used as a justification to police people. We can also think about zoning practices and the way that that plays out, whether that be about school zones, whether that be about homeowners associations, whether that be about voting redistricting. It becomes about protecting a certain form of vote and making these spaces exclusive in ways that we see all across the United States that speak to not just anti-Blackness in these public spaces, but really the protection of certain groups of people over others.
Thank you.
Yes, France doesn't have the same history of segregation as the U.S., of course, and especially urban segregation. Things are a little fuzzier in France with no district laws redlining the way it exists, or covenant laws the way they existed in the U.S. for decades. But clearly, these issues do exist in France, as the police doesn't behave the same way in let's predominantly white neighborhoods or non-white neighborhoods. Mixing of class and racial issues does create specific neighborhoods where the police behaves in different ways. For example, in France, we have this difference between the you and the though, you know, the vous et tu. Tu being an informal way to speak to someone, but the police may use the tu when talking to someone they don't know, which is not the proper way to interact with a person. And yet the police does that, but would not do that, of course, when talking to a white person. All those issues, those everyday humiliations are part of this, the experience of a large share of the youth in France. And people protest in France, they protest, of course, massive acts of violence, such as the murder of Adama Traoré, for example, or George Floyd, but they also protest the everyday little things, you see, the everyday interactions with institutions, the everyday behavior of the police, the everyday little things that accumulate and create situations which are seen as intolerable and create uprising. So all this is important, and it has a geographical dimension. It has a spatial dimension. It happens here. It doesn't happen there. And all these issues need to be studied. But again, as we said earlier, our level of knowledge in France when it comes to these issues is significantly lower than in the United States. As officially speaking, we don't study race as a legal and meaningful category to understand inequality. So the first step, and I say that as a scholar, is, you know, to accumulate knowledge. And knowledge is food for thought, is also food for action. It is the possibility to do things and to push forward and to put pressure onto the authorities and say, look at the data. We need to do something about that. We need to do something about the police. We need to do something about the hospital system. We need to do something about education, and so on and so forth. So this need for data, this need for more social science is something which is harshly debated these days, with a lot of people protesting what they understand as, again, an Americanization of our society. But I also believe that, as I said, this is of absolute necessity. Knowledge is of absolute necessity if we want to understand better what are the social forces, the dynamics, which are playing in French society these days.
Thank you so much. We're going to move to audience question and answer. I want to remind our audience that you have two ways to reach us. One is events@brookings.edu, and the other one is #ArendLecture. So we've already received some very interesting questions, and I'm going to tee up one here, which is really about, it is a topic we haven't really discussed in much length, which is about the rise of the right and the impact the rise of the right has had on the way, on the official responses to anti-racism movements. So Dr. Njai, I'm going to let you answer that first. We want to get in as many questions as possible. So if we can be direct, then we can move on to Dr. Ray for that question as well. Thank you.
Yeah, the rise of the right, not the traditional right, but the, radical
extreme right. Right.
Yeah. Extreme right, which has a strong political basis in France with the Rassemblement National, is a major issue that has also intimidated the whole political spectrum in ways which are such that anti-racist activists are often seen as more dangerous than racist people themselves. The major effect of this rise of this of the right, extreme right, is that it's not easy to find among politicians and friends competent and willing spokespeople who would be efficient when fighting racism, that would build their political career on anti-racism. Anti-racism is often seen as something a little too, touchy, a little too problematic to embrace. So we are talking about the major effect of the rise of the right, which is to marginalize or try to marginalize anti-racism. That is why what happened a year ago was so important, because it was a way to make visible what the extreme right wants, that is to make invisible anti-racist activists.
Thank you. And Dr. Ray?
Yeah, I'll just quickly say that the Department of Homeland Security in the United States has put out a few reports in recent years. And according to them, and as well as my research, the biggest threat to democracy in the United States is domestic terrorists, primarily right-wing extremists, who are white nationalists and white supremacists. We saw that on January 6th. I think in many ways, there are a lot of other examples that we could highlight. But I think what we heard from the general yesterday in Congress speaks to, when you follow the data, you come to that conclusion. And it's definitely something that needs to be addressed.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. Dr. Njai, this is also an audience question. Has there been any discussion of reparations for Black citizens in France, similar to the kinds of discussions we've had here?
Yeah, it's an emerging issue, although not on the same level as in the United States. It's still fairly marginal, being discussed by scholars and being discussed by people actively involved into the anti-racist movement. But it's somehow on the rise, with issues regarding the recent creation of a museum of slavery that is located in the French Caribbean, in the island of Guadeloupe. With the first point would be to think about knowledge and to have a better understanding of slavery as it was, as it existed in France. So need for museums, a need for more education. This debate has been very, very central. When it comes to more, let's say, financial issues, this is really something that is almost a taboo in politics. Some people just go ballistic when they hear about that. So I think that we need time to discuss these issues, to create a democratic conversation And museums, of course, education have a central role in engaging and creating this democratic conversation.
Thank you so much. So we are just about at time. Dr. Ray, did you have any closing thoughts you wanted to share with us? And then Dr. Ndiaye will have you close us out.
Well, I mean, on the topic of reparations in the United States, there's probably never been a better moment. What's happening now, not only at the local and state level, are we seeing passing of legislation for reparations, but on the federal level, the classic 1989, when it was first introduced, H.R. 40 passed a subcommittee in the House of Representatives. There's a Truth and Reconciliation legislation being led by Representative Barbara Lee. And so there's a lot of momentum in this space right now. And I think a lot of people are paying attention to what's going to happen in Congress around policing and reparations.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Ray. Dr. Ndiaye, your final thoughts?
Yeah, well, as a conclusion, I would just say that we need more than ever to maintain well and alive this transatlantic conversation on race that has existed for a century. It's a very fruitful, it's absolutely democratic, and it's absolutely essential when addressing our respective problems in the United States, in the Caribbean, in France, in Africa, wherever you want, around the Atlantic Ocean. We absolutely need forms of conversation, also forms of activism, and to follow up this long and proud tradition of thinking together, acting together, which is not to say that the countries are similar. The national situations, as we know very well, are different. And yet we have issues that can be thought together. We have issues that can be effectively reflected on a transnational level. That is why this initiative by the Brookings is so welcome, because it's so much part of this long and fruitful history I'm talking about. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Ndiaye. Thank you, Dr. Ray. And thank you to our audience for joining us for this important conversation. We are now done, and I hope everybody has a great day. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Rochelle.